Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
Hey there, I am Carol the Coach. What does that mean to reenact something? You know, if you've been traumatized as a kid and you have experienced some sort of abuse, neglect, then what typically happens is if you've developed some coping skills that have ended up being maladaptive as an adult, you reenact that same trauma until you work through it. So I don't want to tell you that your sexual addiction is actually a blessing, but I do want to say that although it has created great havoc in your life, it is something that can make you stronger and can get you to the point where you adapt and adopt coping skills that will make you the best person possible. And that's what we're talking about tonight on Sex Help with Carol the Coach. Hi, I'm Carol Jurgensen-Sheets, and it is Martin Luther King Day, and I hope that you are enjoying a wonderful holiday off from work. Now, I wasn't quite so lucky. I did work. Good thing that I love it. So that I could actually be available to my clients who have this day off. They could take off, come see me, and not worry about how they were going to manage their appointment. You know, that may be you. You may have wanted to get in with a certified sexual addictions therapist, but you wondered, how am I going to take the time off work? Will he or she have the time for me? One of the things that I know about this profession is that everybody who works in this field, we're dedicated to really helping people who have felt shame and guilt, sadness, grief, and anger. And they have resisted coming to a counselor because they didn't know if anybody would understand. Well, we do understand. And tonight, I am so pleased to be talking to Elena Clark Fahler. She is an LCSW. She's a CSAT. She actually supervises CSATs. And for those of you who have heard the show, you know that a CSAT is a certified sexual addictions therapist. We are the experts in treating sexual addiction. I say that humbly because truly this is a fairly new field and not everybody knows what to do with this addiction or hypersexuality. And so I say in all honesty that, you know, 10,000 hours and $10,000 later, I've got the expertise to work with you. And we are lucky enough to have Elena Clark Thaler on, who actually trains certified sexual addictions therapists. She is the clinical director of Recovery Help Now, which is a group therapy private practice in Los Angeles, California. And tonight she's going to be talking about a very specialized niche that I think you'll be interested in. It's the African-American community, especially women, who come to see her for sex and love addiction. So she's going to be talking to us about what things do African-American women have in common who suffer from hypersexuality. And she's going to be talking about, you know, what is sex and love addiction? So that we know the difference between those two classifications, and what do you do to treat, especially women in this field who have love or sex addictions. This woman has been on the circuit. She has spoken nationally, and she's been a sex expert for the last 15 years. I mean, she has been an expert and has been featured in Ebony. She was on Magic Johnson's Aspire Network, and she was featured in a documentary that was called In Search of the Black Knight. She also is a frequent lecturer in many graduate schools, and certainly the Graduate School of Social Work at UCLA. So we can't wait to talk with her at about 9:15. Now, you know, if you have a question, that number is 646-595-3284. And I actually get more emails than even calls because it can feel kind of scary to call in. You want to protect your anonymity, and I get that. So I was interested in hearing from my listeners who had actually emailed me about a variety of subjects. One of those subjects didn't particularly have to do with sexual addiction, but it did have to do with rage. You know, this was from a man who said, "Carol, my wife rages at me. Anything that has to do with our household, she will go back to my sexual addiction and she will call me names that have to do with the old me, the me that participated in ongoing affairs with others. What would you advise me to do?" And that's interesting because clearly I believe several things. I believe that we end up marrying people who actually will help us to heal old wounds. So if I were talking with this man directly, I'd be saying, "Okay, now tell me a little bit about some of the old wounds, the wounds that you experienced. This woman in your life, how is she manifesting some of the same behaviors that you dealt with as a kid?" And I don't know. I'm not sure what he would say. But I suspect if you're listening to this show and you have a partner and you feel like you get attacked by that person verbally, I suspect you had that same thing going on as a kid. And although there's no reason to tolerate verbal or sexual abuse, it's also an opportunity to see if you can't learn the proper skills to assert yourself, to set limits, to set boundaries, and all sorts of things. So I would ask this man, if he were talking with me directly, I would say, "Hey, give me some ideas of what your childhood was like, who attacked you in your childhood, and how did you stand up for yourself?" Because that can be very, very difficult. And I would really appreciate if this person would be able to identify who took advantage of him as a child? You know, who belittled him? And maybe what area was it that he didn't feel he could speak up about? You know, when you're a kid, you don't know that you can say no. You don't know how to assert yourself, and maybe it's not safe to do that. And as a result, you just learn to take it. Or you disassociate from it. You pretend that you're somewhere else. You get good at that, and then you don't have to deal with the hurt, the anger, the pain. And although those coping skills can be very helpful initially, I mean, literally, they can save your life, when you practice them too often as an adult, you end up tuning out what you really need to do to make your life better and to make your life different. And I always say that, you know, that the defense mechanisms we use as a kid are often the very thing that we need to take a look at and find healthier coping mechanisms as an adult. So that might look like you're somebody who minimized what the other person was saying. You acted as if it was not a problem. Now, as an adult, you may minimize it again just to cope, to live with that person, to diffuse anger. But ultimately, you may need to know boundaries and assertiveness. Now, assertiveness, for most of you, you may know that that's when you're clear and direct about what you want, what you feel, what you need, and believe. The bad news is it does not mean you get what you want. It just means you were grounded. You were able to figure out what you wanted or how you felt, and you were able to talk about it. Tonight I was talking with a gentleman earlier. It involved their child and the safety of their child. And he said, you know, I will not participate in anything that jeopardizes the physical safety of our child. And he was steadfast about that. And boy, I agreed with him. However, what I know to be true is that in his process of saying, I will not allow you to put our child in harm, he talked to his wife like a parent would talk to his daughter. He did not give her any room for negotiation to be heard. And as a result, they power struggled. Does that sound like your marriage? Where you power struggle with your wife or husband because you are not willing to compromise a value that you feel is very important? Well, that's the opposite of assertiveness. That might look like aggressiveness. And so, you know, I really want you to think about it. What is your delivery when you're talking to people that you care about or people that you work with, people that you have daily interaction with? You know, it may not be the message you're sending, but how you're sending it that tends to get you in trouble. And therefore, I have said more than once, you know, take a look at your responsibility. Whatever the situation is, ask yourself, what can I do better? How can I be authentic and transparent and honest, but at the same time not push people around, not intimidate them, not threaten them, or what so many of you do is you get quiet and you don't talk about things and you walk away. And that doesn't work either, because that does not teach your partner what it is that you need and that there is a good opportunity, no matter what the conflict is, to work things out. You know, in a healthy relationship, compromise and negotiation are very important. Unless you're being physically or verbally abused, Carol the Coach, and again, I am so excited to be talking with a woman who has made it her mission to help African-American women get through their journey to getting help. So, Elena Clark Faylor, welcome to the show. I'm so happy to be talking with you tonight.
Hello. How are you?
I am excellent. And more importantly, happy Martin Luther King Day. I mean, this is a national holiday that we're all celebrating, huh?
Yeah, it's really exciting. I mean, it's a day that really honors, you know, freedom, and it's a blessing to have that, and really to be able to speak the things that a lot of people, you know, have been suppressed. And you know, this is an opportunity tonight to talk about things that are very difficult about for Black women to talk about. I mean, coming into a therapy office and saying, I'm struggling with a sexual dysfunction or a sex addiction, you know, it took something this powerful, Martin Luther King, for people to feel a sense of freedom and to be able to come and talk to someone and not feel shamed or not good enough. And so I don't know. It's a powerful day, and it's a powerful subject to talk about today.
Well, it certainly is. And you have made it your mission to help African-American women understand more about love and sex addiction. So can you initially tell us, what is the difference between love and sex addiction?
Well, sex addiction is that sexual compulsive behavior. And what that looks like for many people is that they tend to have a pattern of being out of control. There's a continuation of some kind of sexual behavior that is obsessive, and there's a preoccupation. So when someone is, you know, they're supposed to be participating in activities that are really important to them, they may be stuck and preoccupied with some kind of obsessive thought around acting out sexually. And sexually acting out behavior can be again, it has to be compulsive. So not just anyone that participates in anonymous casual sex or prostitution or anything like that is going to be necessarily an addict. It has to be something very compulsive, something that someone can't stop and they've lost a sense of control. And so some of the Black women that come to see me, which is really powerful to be a Black woman who's advertising this, you know, because a lot of Black women who might be looking are like, oh my God, she's African American and she's talking about this particular subject, and I can actually relate and I can talk to someone who works with this, and it's not like I have to try to explain this to someone who has no idea what it is. But some of the issues that African American women come to see me for might be constantly getting caught up in anonymous casual sex, like getting drunk and participating in some kind of sexual activity. Sometimes that doesn't involve substances. It can also be addicted to the sex industry. You know, some individuals who are trying to really get out of the sex industry often see me, and it's hard because, you know, they make money and you know, they're really trying to get out of it. There's individuals that come to see me that are participating in some kind of online sexual behavior, if it's webcamming, doing some kind of sexual avatar or sexting. That's a big one, doing sexting. So sending, pictures that are pornographic to partners and doing kind of like sex talk. But again, not everyone that does that behavior is a sex addict, because I'm sure there's lots of people that are like, ooh, you know, like going to play around with sexting, and that's fine. It's when it's compulsive and they're doing it to the detriment of either their relationships or, it's their life is falling apart and it's becoming out of control, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And, you know, you said it earlier when you said it really seems to interfere with their natural functioning. I mean, in my experience, they are taking away from their family time. It's interrupting their work time. They don't like who they are or they feel a lot of guilt and shame about those behaviors, and that can help delineate whether it's natural behavior or behavior that is out of control and obsessive. So,
yes.
How did you get interested in the specific field of sex and love addiction?
Okay. Well, I didn't even describe what love addiction is. And I'll definitely tell you about how I got into this work. But there are people who are both love and sex addicts. And what a love addict is, and I think many clinicians would say that it's more like an attachment disorder, or someone who has had a very, like an abandoning parent, and they keep playing out the same thing over and over. But basically what love addiction is, it's an overwhelming desire for another person to the detriment of the aspects of their own life, like their work, money, family. So they are so captivated with feelings of romance, intensity, and sexual desire. They feel like their identity and their reality is based off their lover's reactions. So if this person stops loving me, doesn't want to return my calls, it means that I'm worthless and horrible. They have difficulty like having their own individuality, acting without boundaries. And again, you know, in many ways, anybody that falls in love is, you know, becomes a little crazy. I think in many ways, anytime we fall in love, it's like a socially accepted craziness. But
absolutely,
when someone. So the thing is though, is a love addict is someone. It's just they're addicted to that rush, that high, and they just keep getting into the same kind of intense dynamic relationship. A lot of people with domestic violence that are in domestic violent relationships are classic love addicts, people who are just completely, you know, will not leave this relationship that is so abusive and hurtful, but they're just so plugged in and not wanting to let this person go. So they can even have unwanted sex, be preoccupied with fantasy and obsession, be in a lot of destructive relationships. They're just kind of in love with that honeymoon phase. And even these folks will say that they describe that feeling of euphoria and excitement of being in love as even interpreting sex as love.
Addicts that use sex to attach even further, or are they love and sex addicts?
People can be love and sex addicts, and people can be just love addicts. Now, what would make someone just a straight-up love addict is someone who's just captivated with fantasy. Like they're completely attached to this sense of fantasy and excitement and euphoria. And it doesn't necessarily mean it involves sex. It can be someone an example of an extreme love addict is someone who becomes a stalker. You know, someone who's so into this person that they're following them around. You know, it becomes like so intense and obsessive where it's like many people say, I was doing crazy behavior, you know. And now that, you know, with the internet, we can be anonymous, you know. People are, you know, scouring Facebook and trying to search down that guy and can even, I should say, stalk in cyber stalking is what we call it. So it can get really destructive. And I know that it can sound like, oh, really, can that but it can get so destructive that it can really tear apart this person's livelihood to the point where they've lost their job. They can even be a love addict while they're in a marriage. They may be so obsessed with a person outside of their marriage that they destroy their marriage. There's all kinds of different examples of someone who becomes so obsessive with another person.
And so, of course, you got into this field because it is a difficult field, and you have to have kind of a special understanding that it's not just somebody who has unmet needs, but it's also somebody who has such compulsive behaviors. They need a support system to to help them change those and replace those behaviors. So tell me a little bit about some of the things that you do in treatment to help women change their behaviors if they're love or sex addicts.
Well, the first thing is what we have to do is assess. So, like, somebody will come in and they'll just get their whole story, find out history, and usually they come in because something destructive has happened. Either their relationship has gone awry or they're losing their relationship, or they can't handle holding the secret anymore, or maybe they became aware that it just keeps happening over and over and over, and it's like there's got to be something wrong, you know. So most people come in because something hit the fan. So when these folks come in, we're basically starting with damage control and, you know, really assessing their history, their sexual history. It's really interesting because some of these clients that come in, they've never talked about their sexual history with anyone before. It's not very common, you know, and I hate to say this out there in the therapy world, but it's not every clinician will ask about someone's sexual history. You know, and there's a lot of different reasons why they might not. It might not be the reason why the person came in, or, you know, it could even be the clinician having their own problems with sexuality or whatever. But it's important to go over the sexual history. And so I learn about this person's full sexual history, and I can see where this behavior began to start originating from. And some of these folks have had sexual abuse, and so it can be a repetitive behavior of sexual abuse that gets played out over and over and over, or maybe they had an abandoning father or mother that wasn't available, and so they keep playing out over and over this need for this father or this mother over and over and over. You know, obviously that isn't in someone's consciousness when they're acting that out. The feeling feels really real and in the present day moment, and it is real and it feels real. It's just is that there's a possibility that there could be a reenactment over and over and over. So that's why I really need to get a sense of their history. And then from there, we really want to identify what do they want to get out of this? What do they envision a relationship looking like? What do they want? And I have to tell you, many, many clients struggle with identifying what they really want, or they identify these things that are kind of like, well, that happened in, you know, Disney. You know, like, you know, there is no Prince Charming that's going to come and save you. You know, we have to look at how do you save yourself? How do you begin to find that higher, that savior within you, that empowerment? So we have to really identify what they're really expecting out of this. And again, like I said, we're going to do damage control and then start looking at, okay, how do you have healthy sex, or at least a relationship within health, like healthy sex and healthy relationships? What does that mean? What does that look like? Because many of these folks have maybe have had a history of these ongoing, very tumultuous relationships and never had a balanced relationship. And many of these folks also may feel like a healthy relationship boring, you know, that, you know, there isn't a lot of drama or excitement. So the other extreme is to feel bored. And so it's about learning how to find their own passion instead of making their partner their passion. So there's a lot of different avenues and working with clients in early recovery. And then over the course is just like learning how to be in a healthy relationship, how to deal with conflict, how to deal with boundaries, how to communicate your needs. So it's a process.
Okay, so then what might somebody look for to develop that healthy sense, since you said, you know, they may need to find other ways of doing that as opposed to looking at their partner. What might be some avenues for them to look into so that they really do get a better sense of themselves and develop healthier boundaries and healthier avenues for self-care and excitement and stimulation?
Well, I think that for many people in recovery, it's about learning what their passion is. You know, I think that when people have a sense of purpose and passion in their lives, something really shifts and changes. I think that something goes awry when there's disruptions in relationship and trauma, that people start to use, many of the clients I work with, start to look at this individual as their meaning and purpose in life. I mean, I think, you know, even as a parent, I mean, I'm a parent of two children, and I love them. They're amazing. I have to have something even beyond my own children, you know, to have a sense of meaning and purpose. You know, of course, one of my purposes in life is to be a mother and to be available to them. But I also have my own personal meaning and purpose, and that is to provide service, you know, but also to, like, live a life, you know, worth living, to travel. I mean, I have all these other kinds of goals and things that I'm excited about. And for many of these folks, there isn't a lot of stuff going on. There can be a lot of boredom. There can be a lot of distraction from creating something great in their life because, oh, I could fail. I'm not good enough. I mean, sometimes folks use these relationships to distract themselves from doing something really great in their life. And so we start to look at, what have you been avoiding? What have you thought that you could never do? And we start to bring that into developing a goal.
Okay, so what might that look like? I mean, even you said you love your kids to death, and yet you have to find your own purpose and passion. So what might our listeners look towards to develop that?
Well, you know, just like today, and it's Martin Luther King's Day. I mean, his vision was that everyone would be working together to be, there would be this cohesion, this common thought of love and freedom. You know, that was something beyond being a parent, beyond, you know, his marriage. It was a vision that he had, and he knew that all of us could create that. Now, I'm not saying that everyone has to, like, go to the mountaintop and, you know, like, and create this massive vision. But there are folks that have amazing talents and skills and things that they're interested in, but it's gone awry. You know, they might have been told they're not worthy, that they're not good enough, they can never create anything. And, you know, they may have used these other ways to kind of cope. I mean, some kids have been neglected. And, you know, like some of my clients have used masturbation, for instance, to cope because of so much neglect or abuse. And so they just became compulsive with it, even to through adulthood. And it's like, well, there are other coping skills. We have to learn other coping skills. You can't just go to that as your go-to. And we also have to look at, what are you avoiding in your life that you really want to create, and what are the thoughts and the feelings that are associated that's keeping you from that? And, you know, so there's a lot of encouragement that I do. I do a lot of work with building people up, but also in keeping in mind that we develop goals that feel attainable. I mean, I always think you need to stretch yourself a little bit, but we also want to make sure that, you know, we're not stretching it so far that it doesn't feel like it can be attainable.
Well, that makes total sense. I mean, clearly, people with sex addictions and love addictions have to kind of create those healthy behaviors in addition to working through the healing that it takes so that their inner circle, their middle circle and inner circle are not triggered. So tell me, in your experience with women, African-American women who have love and sex addiction, what do they typically have to deal with from their past that's contributed to this problem?
Well, you know, we're talking about a small population of the people I work with, and, you know, but I have to tell you, a lot of people that come to see me are African American. And I think some of the issues that come up for the women that come to see me, some of them have dealt with being isolated or being told messages about sex is bad, or came from very religious families, you know, and all kinds of different messages about sex. Many of the women I see have been sexually abused, you know, and so both messages of that of religious, of, you know, being bad, and but also being sexually abused, then, okay, then I'm damaged. A lot of trauma work that we do. These folks have either had some level of neglect. Some of the women I work with grew up with some moms, not all, or a father or parent that was just not available, like either working all the time or just not present. There's also a message of, you know, we don't talk about feelings, or family members demoralizing or putting my clients down if they have a feeling, like you need to get over that. It's not a big issue. You're making, you know, a big deal out of it. And also mental health services are not looked upon in the Black community as something that, you know, is for a high-functioning person. You know, there's a belief system that people who go see a therapist are crazy, you know. And I tell my clients, I don't have any crazy clients, okay. All of my clients are doing, you know, have learned skills and aren't working for them, and we're developing new ones. And so that's not crazy. That doesn't sound crazy to me at all. And so, you know, we have to walk through a lot of different stigmas about coming to see me. And also a lot of African-American clients will come see me because, okay, I don't want to have to explain what it's like for me to go into a store and feel like someone, you know, they're looking at me as, did I steal something? Or that feeling of, like, being the only Black woman in the room, you know, and you're a professional. You know, it's like we have an understanding that, yes, those issues happen, versus speaking to someone who hasn't had that experience and having some fear that you'll be invalidated if you bring up a situation and someone say, really, does that still happen? It's like, yes, it does. So there's a layer that we just kind of get past and just go, okay, we can have a common language and, you know, I'm understood.
Absolutely. Now, you know, we're talking African-American women, but in general, is there a difference? In other words, do women's behavior look different from male sex addicts? And if so, what's the difference?
Absolutely. Well, you know, I think just in when I used to work at the Sexual Recovery Institute, I hope I can say that, here in Los Angeles, and then I left and branched out and did my own thing. And I really wanted to provide services primarily for women, because when I was working at this other agency, there was so much emphasis on men, and men were coming in droves to get help. But there was no women coming in. And if the women did come in, it was such a shaming experience because they're coming to the Sexual Recovery Institute. And, you know, many women would say, well, I'll just say this. If a woman's coming in for sex addiction, they're considered a slut, right, at least in the eyes of society. If a male comes in for sex addiction, they're a slut puppy, or, ooh, you know, you did it, kudos, you know, oh, that's not a problem. There's a whole different, just in the way of our culture, about how men and women are treated around sex. Just from that aspect, going off and doing my own thing, I had so many more women coming to see me. And, you know, and I also framed it a little differently. I didn't, you know, call myself the sexual recovery, you know, like, I didn't put sex in my titles and all that kind of stuff, and so it allowed women to come in, and also some of the pictures I put up and stuff, like, you know, things that people could relate to and go, oh, I could go in there. I could have a conversation with her. So I think with women, you know, just getting engaged first is a big challenge to come in. And then some of the other things that women's sexual acting out looks so – I meet a lot more – sex and love addict women than women who are just straight up sex addicts, or just, you know, there's a little bit of a difference because of the relationship. I often have women who are really attached to the relationship and really identify love in sex. So a lot of the acting out behavior might look more like having an ongoing, like having a history of affairs with married men, like so what we call unavailable men. That could be an example of what it would look like. So this person has always been in a relationship with an unavailable man. That's very, very common. Or, you know, like constantly getting in a relationship with someone who's, you know, across the country. They're in L.A. and the other person's in New York. You know, it's like they are unable to be in a relationship with a real person. They have to constantly have a projecting their abandoning father onto this person over and over and over. So there's a story that keeps playing out into their adulthood. So I see a lot of that. I see a lot of fantasy, and, you know, for men, sex addicts, a lot of male sex addicts I see, and remember, there's love addict men as well. Again, getting in relationships with unavailable people and putting magical powers, like imagining a lot of magical powers on them and then being upset with them if they don't fulfill their expectations. It happens a lot. But male sex addicts I see more like, okay, going to the massage parlor excessively or, you know, chronic masturbation, which women do as well, you know, going prostitution, chronic prostitution. And I see women doing more like Tinder, like I don't know if you guys, if you know about the apps, there's lots of apps, like Ashley Madison, which is, you know, I don't know how much you guys know about that. Ashley Madison, I'm not promoting it at all, but it's where you're hooking up with married people and want to have an affair. So stuff like that. There's something also called Tinder where you literally just, you know, it's an app where you just like, you can pick somebody up. It's just a picture and you like them and you go and meet up for a hookup. So there's a lot of that. Again, sexting, stuff like that. So it just looks, I think men tend to have a lot more outlets with, you know, going to massage parlors and prostitutes. You don't see as many women doing that. But if anything, you see women being the person who's in a sex industry that she can't get out of it. I definitely get clients who are high-end escorts and just can't get out of it, partly because of the money, but also they may be playing out possibly sexual abuse that they had, and it just over and over and over and just, you know. So it's again, there's so many different types of stories, but I hope that helps to give an example.
Well, absolutely, as well as I think our listeners would probably want to know, why would somebody be attracted to married people as opposed to single people? You know, like you said, the what is it? It's not Dolly Madison, but...
Yeah, that's Ashley Madison.
Why would they want to be attracted?
You get into a relationship with a married person and have an affair.
Yeah. What might be in their family that would, you know, that would encourage that or, you know, would create that obsession that they reenacted that exact trauma?
That one's a common one. I mean, it is such a popular app, too. For many people, again, you know, I'm just going to tell you different types of things that I've seen. It's not the thing, but because everybody has their own unique story about how they were exposed to sex, how, you know, how what kind of family system they were a part of. So in many ways, you know, if you're living in a family system for 18 years, you're going to learn certain things. And then you go off and you live your life possibly on your own or go to college, and you take a lot of the same dynamics that you've been in and you just keep living them out with other people. That's why it's really important to look at the early history. But why would someone want to get into a relationship with a married person? I think several things. One is that they may be playing out over and over, being in a relationship with someone who's unavailable, because someone who's married is not available. Someone who's acting out this has to be chronic and obsessive and compulsive, okay? So someone who just has an affair is not a sex addict. So we want to be really clear with that. Just people who have, you know, involved with infidelity are not sex addicts. But people who constantly escape through affairs or constantly get into relationships with people who are unavailable are playing out some kind of early dysfunction of something. And so being in a relationship with someone who's unavailable, they may have had an unavailable parent that was never there, and they were always – and, you know, just imagine if somebody's really far away that you see and you long for them, what do you want to do?
Well, I would think that if you had a parent who was unavailable, because you're asking – ask that question one more time.
So my question to you is, like, when you see someone far away and you're like, ooh, I'm very attracted to this person who's far away, what starts happening inside of you?
Think there's excitement of what can I do to capture that person? What can I do to captivate that person? Especially if I have a lot of unmet needs from my childhood. You know, it drives me even further to want to achieve the end goal of capturing that person. So what I hear you saying is the people that go for married people that are unavailable probably had unmet needs as a kid, and they keep reenacting the trauma. They keep trying to find unavailable people and captivate them so that they can feel whole. Like they would have if they had been.
And it just keeps playing out. That makes it a different player each time.
Yeah, our listeners don't always understand that. And I believe that's an important component to, you know, what is driving you? We have a lot of partners that listen to this show, and they don't know why their husbands or wives go after married people. And obviously, we have a lot of addicts that say, I don't know why I do that either. So I'm glad you explained that so succinctly. It has to do with your childhood, and it has to do with kind of righting the wrongs of your childhood, unfortunately, in an unhealthy way.
Exactly. And then the other extreme is that some people can get into relationships that are very enmeshed. So, like, for instance, let's say you have someone who's all in your face. What do you feel like doing? What is your body? How does your body respond when someone's kind of in your face?
Well, that's really interesting. So give me an example of that.
Well, basically, if somebody was really close to me, because, see, this is an intimacy problem, okay? Love and sex addiction, it's an intimacy problem. So having someone far away, I can project my story onto them. I can't make them real, because if they become real, then they don't match my fantasy, you know? And that fantasy could still be like the unavailable father or something like that. So I can't really have this person be too real to me. But when this person does become real, okay, and they show themselves and they're in, you know, they really show their colors, they're really available to you, they're in your face, that person who's struggling with sex and love addiction can often want to push that person away, because now they feel smothered and they feel overwhelmed and, oh, I didn't want to know all that about you. And I didn't really want you to be completely, like, there. There is this response of feeling kind of suffocated. It's interesting. The more that that's why love – falling in love is so exciting, because it's like you don't know this person. You've made up things about this person. You're excited about this person. You know, you're really like, oh, my God, I just love this person. They're so amazing. I'm going to eat them up. But then when you've had so much of them, you're like, oh, he's driving me crazy. I don't want to see him. He's too available. He's too nice. I can't stand his voice. These folks can have a difficulty with regulation. And so many of these folks were also in the relationship after the honeymoon phase. So once they really get to know this person after the first 2 years, because they say that the honeymoon phase usually ends somewhere between the first and second year. And then after that second year, you're really working with a real person, someone who might have debt, someone who you start to learn more about who they really are and what their job is like, or maybe you're bored, you know, they become more real, and then it becomes too much. So that's a common issue that comes up for these folks as well.
Well, that makes total sense. And do you feel like there is a difference in African-American women and women, Caucasian women, for example? Do you feel like their needs are any different?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we just have some human basic things that we all have, you know, that are, you know, that go beyond the color lines and ethnicity and culture. But then there's actually things, messages and experiences one has being of a different culture. I mean, Black women have high percentage of HIV. You know, Black men are the highest population of HIV. And, you know, it's based off the Department of Health and Human Services in the 2007 findings is that Black women are 15 times higher than white women to have HIV. So what does that mean? You know, that's something that affects the Black culture, the Black community. There are also many Black women who are not married. And I was looking at some stats on that, on marriage. Maybe I can find it. But facts about marriage is that 45% of Black women in the U.S. have never been married, compared to 23% of white women. And that was in the 2006 census. Black women are least likely to marry after divorce, according to the Washington Post. You know, there are many Black women who've also been raised by a single mother. And there's also messages of Black pride, you know, having a pride and being, you know, a strong Black woman, that you can do it on your own. You can do this with hard work. You can be better than a man. And many Black women are in the professional world a lot more than Black men. There's a lot more Black women in professional roles than Black men. So, of course, you know, they may also begin to develop relationships with other cultures. You know, so there's a lot of things that affect Black women that are different than other cultures. And so those things do impact the way that Black women may look at their sexuality or their relationships. You know, and there can be issues around trust. And then, you know, there was, you know, early on, early on there used to be a lot more, I actually have a fact here. When Martin Luther King Jr. made his famous speech, "I Have a Dream," 70% of Blacks were married couples. And in 2002, that number dropped to 48%. And that's from the Washington Post.
Well, and I would wonder what that was about. Why do you believe that difference? Because that's huge.
It's huge. And, you know, and again, I'm not an anthropologist here, but a lot of things could be. You know, it could be introduction of drugs into the Black community, which dismantled the family system. You know, in many Black families, it was multi-generational, where you'd have, you know, your grandmother down the street. Sorry about that. You'd have your grandmother down the street, your grandfather. I mean, you were part of a large community. So it wasn't just your parents you could rely on. You could rely on a larger community. And then, you know, many Black communities, drugs entered into those communities, liquor stores. I mean, all kinds of things that would dismantle the family system. And, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of different theory about why that happened or whatever. You know, and a lot of black men are in prison, and that's a fact that we can't deny. You know, so something has changed in the structure of the black community, which will affect how women, black women will look at their sexuality, their relationships, their partnerships, and what they might have been subjected to. I mean, there's, you know, there can be also a lot of abuse, especially if you're a single mom and raising kids, you're not always there. You're not always available. And there can be an abandoning father, like someone not available. And then here we go. We've started the system right there.
Absolutely. Now tell me, how does an African-American woman develop a healthy relationship to sex and relationships? You know, what does the road look like to moving forward? What do you advise?
Well, what I would advise is you've got to talk to somebody. I think it's really important to not depend on your own self. I mean, we do best when we can reach out in the community and connect with the community. And it's important that you are able to reach out to a community that you feel safe. And so speaking to a therapist, speaking to pastoring, but I have to tell you, some pastors would not be very open to talk about sex or be supportive. So you have to be very mindful about where you're going so that you can talk very openly. And, you know, you're going to hear messages where, you know, your family might be like, oh, you don't need to see a therapist. Oh, you don't need to deal. Oh, just pray about it. Or, oh, you just, and you have to go beyond that. No, you know, if something is really upsetting you and you want to change the pattern of relationships you're having, you need to seek out support. You can't go on your own best thinking. And you want to make sure you're seeing someone who is skilled in this area, that has similar values and beliefs that you do, that will understand you, get you, and also support you in getting you to where you want to go, your goals.
I interrupt you and ask you, you know, I just was asked this question today. I had a couple that were going to see a therapist, and they had been about 6 times, and they didn't think that they were moving forward fast enough, and they didn't feel like they fit. So as you talk about people and getting with a therapist and really getting beyond that, oh, I should be able to do it myself, what are your guidelines for being able to fit with the therapist of your choice?
Well, I'm all about go and visit. And, you know, just because you go get an assessment or meet with this person doesn't mean you're married to them yet. You know, ask, be an educated consumer. You know, go in there and really be clear about what are your goals, what do you want to get. You know, ask this clinician, what tools and skills do you use, and have they been effective? Is there particular ways that you think that, I mean, and honestly, too, I have to say that the treatment for sex and love addiction, of my choice would be cognitive behavioral treatment, because it's about shifting and changing thoughts and behaviors, and I find that to be more effective. And also for couples coming in, you know, many couples need to learn skills, you know.
And can I interrupt you?
You
cognitive behavioral therapy. We're going to be talking about that in a couple of weeks. So I'm glad that you identified that. Elena Clark Failer, I've got to tell you, you have given us a lot of good information. I want to talk about Recovery Help Now, Inc., and people can get a hold of you by going to www.recoveryhelpnow.com. They can find out more about you and the services that you offer. You have been amazing, and thank you so much for being helpful to our community. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. We have to end for the show, but I will have you on again for a wealth of information. I appreciate it.
Thank you. All right. Take care. Bye, everyone.
Bye. And everybody, we'll see you next week for Claudia Black talking about addiction. addiction and how it affects the family. I'm Sex Help with Carol the Coach.